Hello, and welcome to the Teaching in Medicine podcast, where we explore effective teaching of the healthcare providers of tomorrow. We are back for part two with Dr. Brad Post, medical education leader extraordinaire. Please check out part one if you haven't already. We will pick up where we left off. Shifting back to your roles in GME, if you think over the last several years, what are some of the favorite initiatives that you've been involved in?
So I would say, I think a couple. One, I'm very proud of our wellness program at the University of Utah. I think that was one of my focuses coming in when I took on the position here. And that really arose out of, I had had a previous trainee in one of my programs attempt to kill themselves. Fortunately, they were not successful in that and eventually graduated and has done well. And I think for me, along with kind of maybe my own experience in that burnout portion we just talked about, really led me to focus and to early on get the support and money to hire a psychologist as well as a program manager to build our wellness program. We've now added a social worker. And the time I had started that, I remember that the ACGME was just after I kind of was putting this proposal together to start a wellness program. The ACGME began issuing guidance about, well, they wanted programs to build a wellness program. So the timing was perfect, and we were able to get the hospital support to build it. And I really think we have as strong of GME wellness program as anywhere in the country. So I think that's one I'm proud of. Two is really this previous, I talked about dual alignment when I took over the position, and we moved into a single alignment. And I really think building that with the current GME team that I have, which is as good a team as I've ever had, has really been one of the other things that I'm most proud of, at least for my time here.
And looking back to 5-6 years ago, are there any, you know, major changes maybe on the national level or in graduate medical education in general that you've noticed?
I think over time it has really evolved from where trainees, where you just kind of came in and you were in this insular bubble and you just took a patient care of patients, you read a bunch, you went to lectures, and then you graduated and then you learned all the other stuff that it meant to be a physician, the professionalism, the quality improvement, working within teams. You kind of learned that when you left and became an attendee somewhere or a practicing physician. I really think the last 10 years or so, but especially really in the last 5 or 6, there's been an emphasis of, no, it's more than just learning the proper way to put in a chest tube or to do a particular surgery or to do the pneumonia pathway. And that it's really about becoming that overall physician, learning compassion, professionalism, how to take care of yourself and your patients, as well as kind of working within those interdisciplinary teams. So I think that's been a big evolution, and we're still learning how to fit all of that into a 3-4 year training program, or sometimes a 1 or 2 year training program. I think that's one of the biggest. I think the other is increasing pressure on everyone involved just with financing GME programs that continue to want to get larger and grow, but really no, you know, obvious sources of money. And so having to rely on a variety of federal, state, local partners, as well as departmental partnerships, to really fund the GME growth that's needed to take care of kind of the ever-increasing number and complexity of patients.
And going back to what you said on wellness and kind of the shift of focus from not just, you know, knowing your clinical pathways, but being more well-rounded, do you think DB hour changes were helpful in this process or any other thoughts on that?
So I, you know, as I said, I've been the DIO three times now, and unfortunately, two of them were both when the duty hour changes were made. I think they have been well-intended changes or policies, but issued for maybe the wrong reasons without thought of how to do them. And rather than making them thoughtful and flexible, they've been a little more rigid. I do think they had to change. I, for example, in my internship year, was on call every third night for an entire year and often worked 100 hours a week or more. And that really was not a good year. And so I think that kind of extreme is wrong. I think the duty hour changes have been good in many ways for trainees, personal lives, in really making us think about, well, what's expected and how much of this is just stuff that doesn't need to be done and what's not really focused on education. But I also do think it's been difficult. You know, I think in the duty hour changes, there was actually less resistance at time from faculties than there were from more senior trainees who really saw this as a big change. I think we're now adapted to it, but it's still a matter of how do you get all the things you need to learn and as a physician into that same length of training as compared to overseas, where training programs may have less stringent hour, you know, more restricted hour requirements than even we do in the U.S., but their training programs are longer in duration. So I think it's a fine balance that we continue to do of how do we really deliver education in a more efficient and optimal way and train people for what they need to know rather than just it's the way we've always done it. None of the studies have really shown there's been improvements in patient care specifically due to work hour restrictions. I think most studies have realized it's a very complex because there's been so many changes in healthcare, it's hard to attribute it to one particular change. So I'm viewing it all as an overall positive for the field that we are still learning how to manage and how to best deliver education, because often we still try to deliver it the way we did 10 or 15 years ago. And I think this post-pandemic world will give us even more opportunity to see how we can deliver it in an improved fashion.
Yeah, so I mean, thinking forward, what changes do you foresee in medical education as our healthcare system evolves? And you can think about sort of the immediate pandemic situation, but also, you know, moving beyond that, what big changes do you think are ahead?
Yeah, I think the first off, and it's something that I realized now before I really learned the lingo of medical education, that I was a very adult learner. I was never really good at sitting in lectures. In fact, in medical school, I took over as kind of the director of the note-taking program so that I could get paid for getting people to take notes and transcribe them. And that way I got free copies of the notes and didn't always have to go to class. And I'm not really good in sitting through an hour-long PowerPoint lecture. I have to be fully admit that. That said, I'm not sure I've been the most proactive at changing my education style from that traditional format. And so I think a lot of the newer educators, such as yourself, and for example, Ryan Murphy, who you just talked to, who's leading our quality improvement and patient safety efforts, just like you're leading the GME education efforts, I think are on the right track with delivering things in a variety of formats through podcasts, through short videos, through short articles, and not strictly doing long seminars or hour-long lectures. And I really want to see more and more of both medical school education and GME move to that. And I think the pandemic has accelerated that process with trainees learning to do telehealth more, to getting education delivered either online or in other asynchronous methods. And I really think that is kind of the immediate change, as well as this year is going to be a fascinating in how programs recruit and select, as well as how trainees select which programs to go to. And so we've been developing recruitment videos and figuring out how people are going to do all the interviews online. So I think those are going to have huge immediate impacts on medical education, especially graduate medical education.
I hope that this year has been a lesson in adaptability and kind of learning how to reach more tech-savvy generations, just because we can't do as much of the in-person lecturing as we could before.
I think you're right. And I've heard from many program directors that they see this current situation as really an opportunity to do just that, but as well as deliver curricular content of, hey, this is how public health affects you, your patient population, and individual patients. And it's kind of just a case study in how a disease can affect entire health systems and how the health system has to adapt to it, both educationally, but more importantly, patient care-wise. And I think long-term, you know, the holy grail is always going to be competency-based education. Why does every pediatric resident have to do 3 years? Why does every particular general surgeon need this exact of many appendectomies? Aren't there people who can learn it in 2/3 of that time? Are there some people who need almost, you know, 1.5 the length of that to successfully get where they need to be? You know, obviously that creates recruitment nightmares, scheduling nightmares, all of those things, but they can be overcome. But it's going to really take a multi-faceted approach, because there's board certification requirements, there's ACGME training requirements, there's payment issues. So there's a lot of things that are going to need to do that. And I think that over the next 5 to 10 years is kind of one of the big, I guess, holy grails that we need to get to. And I think the other is really how to continue the efforts, and not just continue, but accelerate the efforts of how do we get our physicians and really all our healthcare workers to better reflect the ethnicity and cultural aspects of the patient populations we serve.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that conversation is at the forefront of a lot of minds in education leadership, and I'm really curious to see kind of what comes out of all of this.
Yeah, I think this year has been a year like very few other years in the history of the U.S. or the world. I think just like with every other major change that occurs, there have been both positive and negative things that can come out of it. And I really think it's an opportunity to accelerate some of the things that has to happen in medical education. It's really made that, it's accelerated that process. And now I think it's all of our job to kind of make sure that we lead those transitions as to the best that we can.
I'd like to kind of do some big picture reflecting on your long and successful career. When you think back to sort of the first half of your career, are there certain experiences or certain things that you said yes to that really set you up to be an effective leader later on?
Yeah, I really think those where I was approached by someone I trusted, a mentor or a good advisor, to say, hey, here's an opportunity I think you might find interesting and they could really use your assistance. Those almost always paid off to something that I enjoyed and kind of enhanced my skill set, I guess. So I really think listening to those who have a vested interest in your career and taking their advice is important. I think I probably, in retrospect, didn't do a good enough job of appreciating those opportunities at the time. And I think early on, I was always maybe thinking about, okay, well, what's going to be next, rather than kind of enjoying what I was doing at the time more than I should have enjoyed it more than I was at the time, I think.
I think that's really wise advice. Do you have any other pieces of advice looking back that maybe you wish you had known early on?
I am still learning things every day. I think the burnout, going back to that, I think I saw it coming, and it wasn't the job I particularly wanted. I was up for two positions at the time, and I really wanted the other position, which was more involved in graduate medical education rather than the chairman role. But it was kind of made clear to me by the leadership that I could do both, or I would be the pediatric chairman alone. And I just felt I couldn't do both, and I'm glad I didn't choose to do both. But I wish somehow I had rethought that and maybe approached then the chairman job with a different mindset, because I think I took it without really thinking about the consequences and preparing myself for that role better. And I think that partially contributed to that burnout.
And for listeners, you know, maybe medical students, trainees who really would like a leadership role in education, what are some good ways that they can get their foot in the door?
It's a great question that lots of people ask. My advice is really be the best educator or teacher you can be in every interaction. And that's just at the bedside, on rounds, giving a lecture to a group of students or trainees. People notice, and I will say for talented, motivated people, there are always opportunities. And as you take those and move up, you will get more opportunities. And so sometimes we want to jump to a level or two down the road, but I think that pathway is very important. And I will say that if you are a good educator who really cares about your learners, you will be given more opportunities. And then I think the other is to really find a mentor or two, or a group of mentors who really care about you and maybe offer diverse opinions, but really have your interests and career as their main motivation.
And then looking back on your career, what are the things that you're most proud of?
I think that I have, for the most part, been successful in the jobs I've taken on, where I felt I left it in a better shape than when I took the position. I think I've prided myself on building teams that worked well together. And I think finally, probably for me, by far my most important or my most valued role throughout it has been a mentor. And then I still have a wide group of folks who contact me frequently from across the country just to run by something or write them a promotion letter or whatever. And they always kind of apologize, saying, I know you're very busy, but I don't think they realize that actually is probably what gives me the most pleasure or joy in my professional life, and that it's often a welcome break to talk to them or to write a letter for them and stop reading a policy or working on a guideline or something like that. So by far the biggest joy I've had, or biggest, I think, reward that I've felt in my career is being a mentor for others.
And I think that, you know, although you won't be going to the office every day, your impact, your legacy, your involvement is far from over, because you have so many people that look to you as a mentor and are, you know, continuing to make their own impacts because of your influence. So.
Well, thank you. I would hope that's true, but I don't know. So, but I know that I'm leaving GME here in very, very capable hands.
So thinking about retirement, how did you know that this was the right time for you?
I will say that I had always kind of in my head planned to stop being a physician in somewhere around 57, 58. I'm a couple years off, but not by much. And so I'm retired at age 59. And for me, it was always kind of what I thought I would do. And the timing does feel right. I think the way that it's happened, my original goal was to give up all administration for my last couple of years and just be a clinician. It worked the complete opposite way of that, where I gave up the clinical my last year and had slowly phased that part down and assumed a more administrative role. Actually turned out to be a good way to do it. Because I think I've always just find myself as a physician first and an administrator second, or maybe even more down the road. And so it's really been a good way to transition. And so at each phase, as I've kind of gotten off or given up, say, the clinical aspect, or gotten off various national committees, or given up a particular role, it's actually felt like the right thing to do. So I think the timing turned out to be the right for me.
And so what are you planning to do in retirement? I don't envision you slowing down much, but rather kind of just changing what you're doing.
So my wife is not worried. Many people have asked her, you know, with me being home all the time. I'm one of those, I will say, they're fortunate or rare people who've never really been bored a day in my life. So we had planned to do a lot of traveling. We will see what happens in the next year or two. But I am kind of a true lifelong learner. I've used half of my GI Bill to date. I got a business degree earlier in my career, and then I used part of it to attend a brewing program at UC Davis about a year and a half ago, which I was fortunate enough to do, kind of in a mini sabbatical. And then I am going to be starting a master's degree in World War II history. It's through Arizona State and the World War II Museum next month. And that'll be a two-year program that will finish up my GI Bill. And then we'll see from there.
I can attest from some GME get-togethers how good your beer is. So if you open a brewery, I'm first in line for a pint.
Well, thank you. I will say that my original plan, when I had talked about and always had this plan to retire by about 57, I was going to be either a high school history teacher and basketball coach or open a brewery. I think both of those probably won't happen because I've decided I don't want to quite work that hard. But I will continue to pursue both passions.
That sounds wonderful. I just have one last question for you that I ask of every guest, as you know. So what is your teaching pearl or piece of advice that you'd like to leave us with today?
I think is really to get to know and care about your learners. And I think those relationships you can build by just taking that little bit of extra time pays off. One of the things I've always done my first day of service in the PICU, it takes a little bit of extra time, is I sit down the first day before rounds and we just kind of talk about, first we do kind of a icebreaker and we talk about where folks came from, where they went to school, and then usually an icebreaker question of their favorite vacation ever, maybe the best movie they've ever seen or something like that. And then we just go and we talk about kind of my expectations for them for the week and what they should expect of me. And then I kind of ask them what they want to get out of that week. And it's amazing that how much it builds that team camaraderie and really lets us get off to a good start. And I try to make it that I always am approachable, and so that they can talk to me about any of the issues that they're having, either clinically or professionally. And so I think really demonstrating that you care about the people you're educating and kind of having that open door policy is kind of the best advice I can give to anyone who wants to be who wants to be a medical educator.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this advice and for sharing your story with us. It has been a privilege to talk with you today, and I just want to sincerely thank you for all you've done for me and for my career, but also for all of our colleagues in GME. And I know that I speak for many when I say that we'll really miss you here at the university, but we wish you all the best in retirement and your continued learning.
Well, thanks. And thank you for everything you've done for GME in your short couple of years here.
Please send any comments or suggestions to teachinginmedicinepodcast@gmail.com. Please like us on Facebook and Instagram, and follow us on Twitter @teachinginmed.